The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network is proud to present The Orthodox Medievalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of history, a professional writer, and a priest of the Russian Orthodox Church. His web journal can be found at russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, folks, welcome back to another edition of the Russian Orthodox Medievalist. And our goal here is to clarify major elements in both Orthodox and Russian history with an eye to a true solid historical revisionism, but also to continually show Russia as, at least today, the nexus of the battle against the New World Order. And so everything that we do, we're going to be jumping around quite a bit here. We're going to be dealing with different areas of history, different areas of theology and literature and things like this. But the purpose of it all is the same. The purpose of it all is to have my audience fully comprehend, understand the basics and some of the more revisionist elements in Russian history that are salient to our struggle against globalization and the New World Order. And an understanding of Russia is central to that because, as of right now, the Russian state and society is mobilized against the New World Order. And what we're going to do tonight is we're going to deal with a little-known and little-studied area of Russian history, and that is the immediate post-Petrine era. We're generally going to be going from Catherine the First, who rules from 1725 to 1727, straight up to a very strange period, almost a foreign occupation of Russia by the Germans under the two Anns, as I call them, who rule from 1730 to 1741. We're talking here of Anne of Holstein, who is the mother of Peter III, and Anne of Courland. These two rule right until the middle of the 18th century, and they are the immediate successors of Peter the Great and the immediate predecessors of Catherine the Great. This era is not studied very much, and in fact, Russian textbooks on Russian history have a tendency to gloss over this era, but it's a very strange era, and a lot of people, especially old believers, hold that the Russian monarchy largely fell in this era, and that subsequent monarchs were shadows of old Russia, and in fact ruled over this weird hybrid monster of the Russian Empire, which is a hybrid between a quasi-European culture dominant in St. Petersburg and some of the other cities, and a mass of peasants who had nothing to do with the European culture, wanted nothing to do with it, and in fact, for the most part, held on to the ancient forms and traditions of old Russia that, at least in the 18th century, were officially discouraged. We've dealt with Peter the Great in this series of talks, and now we're going to deal with his immediate successors. And it is an unmitigated disaster, because all Peter really did was create a small ruling class in distant St. Petersburg around a new group of people known as the service nobility, were dressing like Europeans. They were, in many ways, they were either speaking German or French. Some were speaking Russian. That were isolated from the common population, and the common population were being ground up in warfare and in very high taxes. So what happens is, 1725, Peter dies. He doesn't name a successor, but There two factions develop, and there is a faction for Catherine I, basically located in the Senate. The Senate is an institution created by Peter and filled with Peter's favorites. Catherine I was a German woman. She had been a serf, and her only claim to the throne is that she had been Peter's lover for a long period of time. So it seems to me highly doubtful whether she in fact was a true empress, even though she was proclaimed as such and ruled until her death a few years later. There's somebody else. Old Russia, the traditional Russia, wanted Peter II. Peter II, unfortunately, will die at a very young age. He will die of smallpox. Peter II is the son of Alexis's daughter, Natalia. Alexis is Peter's son, who Peter actually tortures to death, believing him to be an agent of Austria. So this would make Peter II, Peter the Great's grandson. Now, the Senate declares very quickly for Peter's lover, the serf girl from Germany, Catherine I. Catherine was illiterate. She had absolutely no claim to the throne. But it was fairly clear that she was intelligent, that she had been Peter's confidant, and that she knew the state. She knew Russian governance. She had a string of male lovers, and this is going to be something that typifies female rule in Russia, and you have a long string now of female rulers in the Russian Empire, and they normally declare their favorite by who they're sleeping with at the time. That the man who Catherine is sleeping with, once she becomes empress, she's proclaimed empress by the Senate and by the elite of Petersburg, her favorite is a guy named Menshikov. Menshikov is going to show up quite a bit. He actually wants to himself become ruler of the state and place his daughter within the royal family. That'll come a little later. But he actually rules in the place of Catherine I. Under Catherine I, which is in essence a regency of a guy by the name of Menshikov, he does a few things. They create the Russian Academy of Sciences. They begin a substantial scientific exploration of Eastern Russia and Siberia. This is where the cult of personality around Peter comes from. Peter was not a popular ruler, particularly with the lower classes. And so the elite, once Catherine is placed on the throne, Catherine and Menshikov and the elite in the Senate in Petersburg, the elite of the city, will create really the first Russian cult of personality. In this case, a secular cult around Peter as almost a reincarnation of the old Roman emperors. Also in this era, you have an explosion of newspapers and an explosion of literacy. There is a reorganization of the Russian aristocracy that had been impressed under Peter the Great, for better or for worse. And Catherine had asked Peter II to be her successor. In terms of foreign policy, the main issue was, and this is really the last time this is going to happen, there will be a treaty made with the Austrian Empire, the purpose of which is to control a major rising power in Central Europe and Eastern Europe, and that is Prussia. Menshikov is essentially ruling in this period of time. He is close to Peter, he is close to the Senate, he is close to the Petrine organization. He viewed himself as the actual ruler of the state in this period of time. Menshikov views himself as a czar, and in fact he is ruling in the name of Catherine I, who in fact is ruling in the name of Peter the Great. Catherine wanted to place Peter II in a marriage alliance with Menshikov, and to have Peter II marry into Menshikov's family. And Peter II, as a very young boy, is being taught and being raised by those loyal to the Menshikov clan. In fact, Menshikov will eventually come to call himself Generalissimo of the Russian Empire. So those who, you can clearly see how those who believe in old Russia, those who believe in the ancient Orthodox life, are rejecting Peter and certainly are rejecting Catherine I and Menshikov. Menshikov makes himself very unpopular. He is, Peter II will eventually come to typify the reaction against Peter and reaction against those who want to glorify their Petrine legacy, under the Menshikov clan. You know, at this stage, between, you know, 25 and 27 of the 18th century is in fact ruling the state. But even as a young boy, Peter II is rebelling against Menshikov's rule. He is rebelling against the Petrine legacy. Peter II's aunt Elizabeth, who will eventually take over, also dislikes Menshikov. Elizabeth is Peter I's daughter and is quite clearly a threat to Menshikov. 1727, after the death of Catherine, Menshikov is arrested. And the guards, the military formations around the palace in Petersburg will go over to Peter II. And he, what Peter II will do, even as a young man, will reject Menshikov's daughter as his fiancée. But there is another aristocratic clan behind Peter II, and that is the Dolgorki. So now you have, like you have after the death of Alexis, you have two families vying for power. Central control, central rule has fallen to pieces. Foreign powers such as Sweden or Prussia have this notion that maybe pieces of Russia can be carved out. The fact is that without a solid rule in the Russian capital, Russia is in a lot of trouble. Now you have two powerful clans, the Dolgorkis and the Menshikovs, that are fighting each other off, and Catherine I, who had absolutely no claim to the throne whatsoever, is not Russian, was not Orthodox, at least, you know, not in a substantial way, was the primary patron and lover of the Menshikov clan, but Peter II is now the point man for the Dolgorkis. And so central rule has completely fallen apart. And what Peter II will do is declare himself essentially the sign of old Russia, an anti-Petrine figure who wants to return Russia to its pre-Petrine rulership. He will marry the oldest daughter of the Dolgorki patriarch. And there is, therefore, this now institutional reaction against Peter the Great. And so you see already a major cleavage, a major cleft in Russian society that is between the Petrine European reforms and the aristocratic rule under a strong emperor in St. Petersburg, which is now typified by Catherine I, 1727, dies, and the Menshikov clan. On the other hand, you have those who still hold to a strong monarchy, but these have a tendency to be Muscovites. These have a tendency to be people who believe in old agrarian Russia, not a European empire. And this is institutionally manifest in the life of Peter, the very short life of Peter II and the Dolgorki clan. The Dolgorki will in fact take over the government while Peter II, still a young kid, at this time, you know, he'll die at 17 in 1730. So he's, you know, 14, 15 when he's married off to the Dolgorki clan. And so you now have another short era of oligarchic rule in Russia. Peter II will eventually attempt to rebel against his aristocratic patrons. But unfortunately, he will die of smallpox at the age of 17. In 1730. So, in this era of Catherine I, Peter II, the immediate post-Petrine era, you have a seven-year period, which is fairly peaceful. You have, but you do have a period of time where these two clans have their own foreign policy issue. The Menshikov clan is pro-Austrian. They view Prussia as the main threat. On the other hand, the Dolgorukis are pro-Prussian and view Austria as the main threat. And this is actually going to be very significant in terms of the European alliance system the first half of the 18th century. The other significant thing that Peter II will do is, given his alliance with Prussia, he believes that will stabilize Central Europe. He then goes to the Far East and begins building a trade relationship with the Chinese. So that Peter II holds that his alliance with Prussia will permit the Russian Empire to now expand to the East, which had not been thought of really since the days of Ivan the Terrible. That Russia's destiny, in fact, lies with the Chinese, with the Japanese, the Muslims of Central Asia, not necessarily in Europe. And so you see this cleft in Russian society. Where is she going to go? Is she an Eastern society based around the agrarian Orthodox faith, or is she a European empire? And, you know, with everything that goes along with that, European wars, high taxes, European tastes, secularization, increasing secularization of Russian society, and so you have the cleft that exists around the legacy of Peter the Great. Okay, now, we are back in this very, very strange period of Russian life. The period that I call, in the past, the period of the two Annes. That is to say, the Anne of Holstein and Anne of Courland, both German women related to the Petrine line, the Romanov line, through Catherine the First. The two Annes will rule in succession between 1730 and 1741. The significance of this era is multifold. First of all, it shows really the German and European domination of the Russian state. In this era, a German aristocracy will be imported under the two Annes and will rule until the rise of Elizabeth, who is Peter the Great's daughter. You have a complete disintegration of central rule in the Russian Empire, and you have substantial factionalization within Russian society, even over and above the cultural cleavage that has developed since the reign of Peter. And even more than this, you have old Russia, the old believers, really believe that the Russian monarchy has fallen. That Catherine the First, this is not Catherine the Great is Catherine the Second, Catherine the First has no right to rule. Peter the Great was a Freemason, that this is no longer an Orthodox empire, this is now a secular European empire, and therefore old Russia has to go underground. And that mentality develops consistently throughout this era with the Old Believers movement, which in this era will amount to roughly 40% of the Russian population. So this is not a minor issue. And even Solzhenitsyn holds that this cleavage is absolutely definitive in Russian history between the Old Believers movement, those who believe in Old Russia, and the agrarian Orthodox realm, and those who follow Peter I, the secular European empire. And these two Annes are in that Petrine line, in that European line. The early death of Peter II has pretty much put an end to any hopes of old Russia retaking power. Peter had created an institution called the Senate. It was meant to be an advisory body. It was filled by Petrine appointments with the most important aristocrats of the realm. Eventually, the Senate will become sort of like a czarist supreme court. And these people are in control. After the death of Peter II, you've had now the disgracing both of the Menshikov clan and the Dolgoruki clan. The remainder of the major aristocratic clans are sitting in the Senate, and in the early years of Anne of Holstein's reign, they are in full control. the major aristocratic factions in the Senate draw up, after the death of Peter II, will draw up essentially a constitution. They wanted to bring in Anne of Holstein, who will eventually be the mother of Peter III, as a puppet ruler with the aristocracy in control. They wanted to create a constitutional oligarchy ruled by the Senate, which is another way of saying ruled by the Petrine oligarchs of the of St. Petersburg. So they bring in, pardon me, I actually meant Anne of Courland, Ivanovna. Anne of Courland is brought into Russia. They view her as a weak figure. And the conditions that they lay down to bring her in and crown her empress are the following. Number one, she must rule with the Senate, which at this stage has 8 members. Number two, any declaration of war, she has to go to the Senate to get their approval. Number three, that the monarch cannot confiscate the property of the oligarchy under any circumstances unless approved by the Senate. And that when she dies, or if she is retired, or if she resigns, that the Senate then chooses a successor. And finally, that she will be removed from office if she violates any of these conditions. The population of Russia is outraged. The population is outraged. The lower classes are outraged. The lower nobility is outraged. They view these conditions not as some sort of a constitutional rule. They view it as oligarchy. They view it as the institutionalization of the Petersburg aristocracy as collective dictators over the society. And in fact, these Senate clans will take action in terms of confiscations, exiles, high taxes against these elements of the lower nobility out in the countryside. Here you have a major battle between monarchy on the one hand and aristocracy on the other hand. In fact, once the Senate gets wind of the fact that the population is outraged by these conditions, the Senate will place Anne under heavy guard. That there was only one person who had access to Anne under these circumstances, and that was the church. Anne had converted to Orthodoxy, even though she had been a German prior to this. Her confessor is a guy by the name of Archbishop Theophania. Theophania is opposed to the Senate. He is opposed to the dominant nobility, and the church is engaged in secret communications with Anne through her confessor, Theophania. The church is urging her to reject the conditions and to rule as a popular monarch in her own right. Eventually what happens is the following. Anne is emboldened by these people. She will call the Senate to order. And what she faces instead of the Senate is an assembly of 800 people. These people are from all walks of life, from all over the Russian Empire, who demand that the Senate be rejected, that the conditions be torn up, and that Anne rule in her own right, and that's exactly what she does. And these senators will be exiled, and the Dolgorukiy clan will be exterminated. Now, what to do? How do you rule now that the major clans of the aristocracy have been scattered all over Russia? Their money and properties have been confiscated. What she does is bring in her German friends from Courland and the duchies surrounding that area. Guy by the name of Byron from her hometown will take over the government. Anne herself does not rule in her own right, but a new imported German oligarchy will rule Russia in this period of time. Byron will create a secret police service. He will attempt to do everything to expunge all things Russian from St. Petersburg. Anne did not rule here. The Germans recreate the army. They tighten military discipline. They tighten methods of tax collection. They completely redo the educational system and, in fact, institute a system of formal examinations that they have brought from Europe. Essentially, they will create a Russian West Point to train Russian officers on the German model. So now the average Russian citizen, average Russian peasant, average Russian serf is being driven farther and farther away from loyalty to St. Petersburg, from loyalty to loyalty to the monarchy. The fact is, at this stage, the Russian monarchy has zero popular support, and the old believers continue their secret agitation that there is no Russian monarchy anymore. This bunch of oligarchs cares only about money. Anne and her successor, Anne of Holstein, she will spend a fortune on lovers, on clothing, on paintings, on bringing architects to build from Italy and France to build extraordinary palaces, while the ordinary peasant, even the low-level noble, the mid-level noble, is in debt and continually suffers. The old believers will continue their struggle and say that there is no monarchy anymore. Orthodox Russia has fallen. We need to go and form our own communities, to go off to Siberia, to go off to Central Asia, to go off into the woods, into the mountains, and to preserve the traditions of old Russia until a true Orthodox monarch can be crowned. And, of course, they will wait a very long time for that to happen. The Germans, after the death of Anne, essentially want to maintain their hold on power, and they will import another Anne, this time Anne of Holstein. Also a German, she will be the mother of the Freemason Peter III, and she will take over. And when she takes over, she's invited by the Germans to essentially act as a figurehead. The various factions in this new imported German oligarchy will fight one another for control over Russia. So now you have a non-Orthodox group of people controlling Russia. You have an oligarchy controlling Russia. You have a non-Russian oligarchy controlling Russia. The language of St. Petersburg is now German. The Germans have taken over through Byron and those he has brought from the various small German duchies in the extreme east, Courland, Holstein, etc. Anne shows no activity whatsoever. You just buy her dresses, you bring her men, you bring her wine, she's happy. Oh, but this is what she was meant to be in the first place. She was meant to be a figurehead. So, I mean, is it crazy that the old believers are wrong or are correct in this area to say that there is no Russian monarchy anymore? Orthodox Russia has fallen. Elizabeth finally shows herself. Elizabeth is the daughter of Peter. She's 28 at this period of time. She'll eventually take over in 1741 and rule until 1762. She is very quick-minded. She's 28 years old. Many want her to take action. Many want her to overthrow the Germans, overthrow this useless Anne of Holstein, and to overthrow the system, and to, at least in her case, reinstall the Petrine monarchy. The Navy will be the first important group of people to declare publicly for Elizabeth, and the Russian-speaking military apparatus around the palace will eventually find Lord Byron and kill him, and they will murder the remaining Germans who dominate the system in St. Petersburg. The French, the fact is that Prussia and the Eastern Germans in general have taken over the Russian government. This has alarmed the French for a long period of time, and it's largely French money that will back Elizabeth. The fact that Prussia has now essentially taken over the Russian Empire frightens the French, and the French will become Elizabeth's primary promoters. And she will receive French money and French support. But at the same time, given the unpopularity of the German rulers, it doesn't take much. Elizabeth will visit the elite guards in the barracks in St. Petersburg, and she will introduce herself as Peter's daughter, which of course she is, and she's very charming, and she very quickly gains the support of the military forces. Anne will die in prison in 1746. The Germans are wiped out of St. Petersburg. and Elizabeth, without much work, without very much bloodshed, takes over the government in St. Petersburg. Peter III is then brought in from Holstein to be Elizabeth's successor. And in 1741, Elizabeth will write a resolution against foreign rule. The two powers that have supported her are not just the French, but also the Swedes, who seek to really essentially cajole the population into rising up against the Germans, who also threaten Swedish power. But Elizabeth will double-cross the Swedes and defeat her armies in the extreme portion of northeastern Europe. So there is now a very tight French-Russian alliance made. And, of course, this clearly affects European life throughout the continent. And the only time that this alliance will be interrupted temporarily will be, of course, under Napoleon. And then Russia will fight the French, among others, in the Crimean War. But as a matter of course, this alliance is lucrative. The Russian economy is now, from here on in, be bankrolled by French investors. And at the same time, Austria and England suddenly find Prussia to be a worthwhile ally. So this is clearly affecting very seriously the European balance of power. Elizabeth will, at least early on, she will be a very strong ruler. She reforms the clergy. She kicks the Ukrainians out of the Russian clergy. She wants to split the difference between the old believer movement and the very now westernized Russian church hierarchy. She accepts a lot of the German educational reforms. The administration, of course, has to be completely redone because prior to her, this was all in German hands or in the hands of the two major aristocratic clans that were predecessors to the Byron government. So she has to completely recreate the administration and bringing in only great Russians from throughout the population to staff this. She does something very smart, and she will approach the lower and mid-level nobility who are increasingly in debt, who are increasingly irrelevant in Russian life. And this is part of the cleavage. Peter and his immediate successors will create an administration in St. Petersburg based on foreigners, based on that tiny St. Petersburg elite. And after Peter, you have the Menshikovs and Dolgorukis, and then, of course, the Germans. And the people who now have no voice, not just are the peasants, but the low and mid-level nobility. These people have no role in Russian society. They have no military role that they used to have because the army has been based now on German models. And they're left to languish in the countryside, and the low and mid-level nobility in Russia are not wealthy people. We would call them lower middle class. They owned a few serfs. They generally were on the same level as the Russian serf population. They were deeply orthodox people. They were very good people, as a matter of course. They had been completely cut out of Russian government until Elizabeth. And what Elizabeth will do is seek to increase the position of this key element in Russian society. She'll fail to do this. And in fact, from here on in, this low-level nobility will eventually become irrelevant, and they will sink gradually into indolence. They will sink gradually into irrelevance. But in order to mobilize this strata of the population, Elizabeth will do something that's going to, you know, it's going to have a long future ahead of it, and that is the creation of agricultural banks. These are ways that low-level nobles can take out loans at low interest rates to improve their holdings and to become more solvent financially speaking. The fact is that the oligarchy in St. Petersburg runs everything. They control a huge number of serfs. They are the dominant serf-owning element in society, and the more or less yeoman-style low-level nobility in the countryside simply cannot get it together. She will abolish the death penalty, and she will also abolish torture as a method of punishment, considering them un-Russian. She develops close relations with the French, as I've already mentioned, and in the process of doing this, she develops an anti-Prussian alliance with the French, and the English find themselves panicking, and the British seek to form their own alliance to control Russia, which under Elizabeth has played her hand very, very well, and so the British will approach the Austrians and create a anti-Russian alliance with the Austrian government, and the Austrians will become the primary enemy of Russia for a very, very long time to come. Prussia is growing at a substantial rate. She is unbalancing this balance of power. In 1757, they will be defeated in open battle by the Russians. And the man that she picks to do this is a guy by the name of Alexei Bestuzhev, and he is foreign minister under Elizabeth, and his role is to surround Prussia with enemies. But even though Prussia will be defeated by the Russian armies, that Bestuzhev is very close with the French, the French will also be alarmed by the tremendous growth of Russian power, to some extent, on the French payroll. And the French will be as alarmed as the English with the tremendous growth of Russian power. And so what you have is this slowly but surely very strange alliance of Vienna, Paris, and London to attempt to create a counterweight to the relatively competent leadership in the Russian Empire.
Don't go away, because there's more on The Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Return to The Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
The death of Elizabeth will see the rise of a pro-Prussian faction, and that pro-Prussian faction will coalesce around a very unsympathetic figure, Peter III. Peter III is a Prussian nationalist. He is the grandson of Catherine I. He is the grandson of Catherine I, and therefore the son of the first Anne. He is made a monarch by Elizabeth in the waning days of Elizabeth's rule and will make peace with Prussia. He'll make peace with Prussia after the substantial Russian victories against her and the substantial markets and money that the Russians have gained against the Prussians. And as a result, Peter makes himself very unpopular. with this pro-Prussian, pro-German mentality. Peter III is allied now with Frederick II, and what he will do at the advice of Frederick II is that he will free the nobility from state service. Peter the Great had insisted that all noble families put their money and their power at the behest of the monarchy. Now, Peter III, in hopes to cover over his problems with the population, given his peace with Prussia, he will free the nobility from all state service. This means that state service now will be in the hands of foreigners brought in from Europe and the professional bureaucracy at St. Petersburg. In a stroke of the pen, Peter III has made the Russian nobility completely irrelevant. But Peter III is a Freemason. Peter III is opposed to orthodoxy. He has converted simply as a matter of course. And he attempts to place a complete Prussian rule over the Russian army. Prussian uniforms, Prussian strategy, Prussian discipline. And it doesn't take, he rules only for 6 months. And he will be murdered by the palace guard and the young officers stationed in and around the St. Petersburg area. But he was hated. He was hated because of his pro-Russian stance. The French had become very popular in Russia because of his smoking. Even though tobacco was now legal in Russia, smoking was considered a very bad habit. He was anti-Orthodox. He wanted to Lutheranize the country. And he drove the French cultural renaissance out of Russian territory. But he did do a number of interesting things that deserve to be taken seriously. He brought the beet crop into Russia, which I know doesn't seem like much, but the beet is where the Russians now get all their sugar. So they're no longer dependent on Western sources of this very, very popular crop. The beet sugar adds a brand new, very powerful element to Russian agriculture. He reverses the Petrine policy of bringing serfs to industrial enterprises. This was a major error of Peter, where he wanted to jumpstart Russian industry by forcing bond servants into industrial plants, essentially to be worked to death. Peter will abolish this particular plan, although it's not widely enforced. He will abolish the secret police. He will declare amnesty for any peasants that have rebelled against the Petrine system. And because he doesn't care that much about religion, he will officially tolerate the old believers. So Peter III will eventually be murdered, and his wife of a long time, Catherine the Great, which will take Russia straight up until 1770, right up until the end of the 18th century. Catherine's first act after the murder of Peter III is to eliminate the alliance with Prussia. And but what is eventually going to happen is that she is going to be forced out of that to recreate the alliance with Prussia and create this northern maritime alliance with the British and the Danes, because in the early years of Catherine the Great, the French and the Austrians, the major banking houses in Paris and Vienna, have now joined forces. They haven't. I mean, the French were aware that the Prussian alliance was unpopular, but they also viewed Russia as destabilizing. And they slowly pulled themselves away from this Russian alliance. Catherine, in her early years, sought a weak Poland, which the French wanted to use against Russia. And in fact, it will be Catherine's reign which will finally end the dominance of Poland in this area, that will destroy the Polish state and bring one-third of Poland under Prussia, one-third of Poland under Russia, and the last third under Austria. However, Russia does take action against Poland to not to take new lands, but to regain old lands, which were primarily Orthodox people, what we would call Belarus and parts of northern Ukraine today. They claim that the Polish aristocracy had suppressed the Orthodox faith, which is probably true. And Prussians, for their part, were claiming to take a part of Poland because this was really West Prussia, and there were a lot of Germans there who did not care for Polish overlordship. And, of course, the Prussians claimed, just as the Polish aristocracy had suppressed the Orthodox, they had also repressed the Lutherans. So in both cases, Prussia and Russia were able to carve up Poland for their own purposes, but they were taking lands that for the most part contained either Lutheran Prussians on the one hand or Orthodox Belarusians and Ukrainians on the other. The fact is that Poland was an archaic state. They had maintained feudalism. They had a weak economy. There was no movement forward, and it was just a matter of time before the Polish state essentially collapsed. So, again, what is the point here? The point of all of this is that Russia is now permanently divided. The point is that now Freemasonry and European customs have become dominant in the capital and yet generally are not touching the mid and lower nobility as well as the peasantry. So now you have two Russias. You have the Russia that looks to Western Europe, to England, to France, to the Netherlands, that seeks a maritime empire, that seeks a capitalist class, that seeks secularization, the confiscation of the lands of the monasteries, the modification of the Orthodox faith. Then you have those generally in the poorer classes who support the old Russian popular monarchy, the local control, and a highly monastic understanding of the Orthodox faith. These are irreconcilable opposites. The old believers, as I said, will dominate about 40% of the Russian population and will withdraw their consent from the Russian state. This is the thing. The old believers, old Russia, will withdraw its consent from the Russian state, will say that the Russian Empire has fallen, that there is no monarchy anymore, and that we have to preserve old Russia in the hills. That means that all that's left is a thin strata of Europeanized aristocracy dominating from distant St. Petersburg. The state, really from here on in, is going to be completely isolated from the population because of this, and in fact, substantial proportion of the population will reject the state altogether. And what we're going to see, and we'll talk about this some other time, is the massive peasant uprising of Emilian Pugachev under Catherine the Great that almost completely topples the Russian monarchy. It will be led by the Cossacks, and we will deal with this some other time, but the massive rebellion, but Pugachev will take all of southern Russia, will create his own monarchy under the Cossacks and under the old Orthodox faith. They will actually take all the southern cities of Russia, will threaten Moscow, will include armies of hundreds of thousands of peasants led by Cossacks. The fact is that Pugachev is the last major rebellion of old Russia against the Petrine system and against serfdom and against high taxes and against European empire. We don't have time to deal with that now. We will deal with it soon, however. And I want to say goodbye to you, and I want to thank everyone at Voice of Reason and all my friends there for helping me out and putting this show together. I want you guys to realize that what we're dealing with here is the attempt of seeing Russia as the fighter, the center of the world, the center of the battle against the New World Order. And a full understanding of Russia and her history is absolutely essential. So until next time, God bless. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Medievalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at reasonradionetwork.com.
Yeshua.